So this is our second week of talking about God-onomics, which means that we need to talk about some more candy. And since today is about comparing things one to the other, I figured today would be a good day to talk about the biggest and the best. So let's talk first about the biggest, the world's largest chocolate bar. This is created in the United Kingdom. And it was topped in at about 12,770 pounds. It's over 6 tons of chocolate. And there was actually a competition. The runner-up came in at over 11,000 pounds, and they thought they had it in the bag. And then they lost. So to put that in perspective, that is the weight of a Tyrannosaurus rex, or 5 adult giraffes, or 1 African elephant. That's how big the chocolate bar was. I think I was told the little girl ate most of it. And if Brian was there, he would have also given her a run for the money. So that's the biggest. But let's now talk about the best. Now this is fresh off the presses. This is the top 5 most desired, most sold Halloween candy for 2022. So if you haven't bought your Halloween candy yet, this will be a good resource for you. You can know what the word is on the streets, what the kids are after this year. And number 5 is Sour Patch Kids. And number 4, Skittles. All right. Number 3, if you're a chocolate fan, you like this. Number 3 is Snickers, which was named after what?
A horse.
A horse, yes. Those of you who were here last week, yeah, you get points for that. Number 2, any guesses as to what number 2 would be?
Hershey's?
I got Hershey's, M&M's, Kit Kat. It is M&M's. M&M's. And Pierre, you jumped the gun a little bit, because the number 1 candy this year, coming in like a bullet from number 2 last year to number 1 this year, is Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. Of course, Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. Now, why am I talking about chocolate and candy? Well, because I love chocolate and candy, and it's almost Halloween, and I keep seeing it everywhere, and I can't get it out of my head. But the other reason is to remind us about what I call the candy bar fallacy, which we learned about last week, and it is this. If I were to ask you, what was Jesus' favorite candy bar, and you were to think in your mind what it would be, my guess would be that your favorite candy bar would have an influence on your guess. It is very unlikely, I would argue, very unlikely that you would think that Jesus' favorite candy bar was a candy bar that you loathed. But in reality, we don't know, right? So when we come at the parables, we have to remember that we don't know what Jesus meant when he said these parables. We can guess. We can maybe take some other scriptures and try to tie them together. But in the end, we really don't know. And what the candy bar fallacy teaches us is that we can't help but bring our own ideas, our own experience, our own interpretations onto these parables when we interpret them. So keeping the candy bar fallacy in mind, let us dive into the parable of the talents that Patty read for us this morning. Now, it starts off pretty simple enough, right? You got 3 servants. The landowner goes away for a while, puts 3 servants in charge of money. One gives 5, one he gives 2, which when I made these graphics, I thought it was 3, but it's actually 2, and one he gives 1, right? And then goes away for a while, comes back, finds out that the first one doubled it up, second one doubled it up, and the third one buried it. Put it in the ground. And so the landowner says, you should at least put it in the bank. I could have got interest on this. So takes the talent away from that third servant and gives it to the first one. And then the end, it says, those who have been given more, those who have been given much will be given more. And those who have been given little, even what they have, will be taken away. And then that third servant is banished. So what are we to make of this parable. How are we to interpret it? Well, if you have ever learned this in Sunday school when you were a kid, the first thing they try to do is make parallels to all of the different people in the parable. So the landowner is who? God, right? The landowner is God. And the servants are who? Us, right? People, exactly. And then what are the talents? You say, what did you say? Other people, our abilities, okay. Yeah, I've always heard that our talents are our talents, our skills, the gifts we've been given by God that each of us are, that can, the things that we do well, the things that we can contribute, that we can offer. And those can vary. It can be anything from good analyzer to a diplomat to an artist or actor or motivator or engineer. It can go into science or historian or philosophy. People who do things really well with their hands, people who do things really well with their minds, people who can play an instrument or who can sing. All of these different kinds of skills. And when we develop these skills, they do what? They increase. We get better, right? When we develop these skills that God gave us, we get more of them. We do better. And when we don't develop these skills, they go away, right? I call this the use it or lose it mentality. And it comes from this example that one of my friends when I was a kid, he had to take piano lessons every single day. And he hated it. But he stuck with it. And his piano teacher said, if you do not practice, she was very strict, if you do not practice every day, you will forget what you have learned. And you will not get any better. So he stuck with it till about high school when he started being more interested in girls than piano. Ironically enough, they were more interested in his being able to play piano. And I kept telling him, you gotta stick with this piano. Look, it's doing really well with you. But this is the mentality, and this is the lesson that we have today. That we have each been given unique skills by God, and we need to develop them in order for them to increase. Otherwise, they will just go away. But I have a couple problems with this interpretation. Okay? The first is the use of the word talent. So the etymology of the word talent, as in America's Got Talent, when we talk about talents as skills, the etymology of that word comes from the interpretation of this parable. So in Jesus' time, talent meant money. It meant a lot of money. A talent in the time of Jesus was equated, the historians believe, to about 20 years of wages. So that would have been about 70 pounds of gold. And in modern day equivalency, I looked this up, the annual average income of someone in Barrington is $65,000. So that would mean that 20 years wages would be about $1.5 million. Now I've had a lot of bosses, but never has a boss left on vacation and left me $1.5 million. Much less $5 million or plus what he gives to the first servant. So it's a lot of money, right? And it's very valuable. But this idea of talent, we have equated to skills. We don't even really think about it as money anymore. We think, oh, this is just a metaphor for all of our skills and abilities. And so we've changed the meaning of the word talent forever. To the point now where when people read this parable, they think, oh, this is an obvious translation because that's what talent means. And so the sort of thing becomes this mirror reflection on itself. When in reality, remember the candy bar fallacy. We don't know if that's what Jesus actually meant when he said talent. And that's why some translations translate it to bags of gold instead of talents, to try to ease that confusion. And the second issue that I have with this interpretation is the individualistic nature of it. Right? To say that when we look at this parable and we think, oh, this is about the singing ability that God gave me and that I need to practice singing. It's very individualistic, right? It's all about me, as if Jesus was saying to each and every person, you need to develop yourself. Which I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I think that that is a really great lesson. But it's not really in line with what Jesus was trying to teach at that time. If anything, his audience was too individualistic. They were too concerned about themselves. They needed to start being more concerned about others. This parable comes in Matthew 25, which is a chapter that is famous for the parable that comes next, where Jesus is talking about the sheep and the goats, and he talks about how when the judge came back and said, some of you visited the sick, cared for the hungry, fed the hungry, clothed the naked, visited the imprisoned, and some of you did not. And whatever you did to the least of these, you have done for me. It's not about the individual. It's about what the individual does for others. So that's why I think that this idea of it all being about me and what I get, I think is not really in line necessarily with the greater teachings. But what really, really gets in my craw about this interpretation is that it completely leaves out that third servant. Boy, was this guy treated cruelly. Right? I mean, he comes back. What did he do? What was his big sin? Was that he just kept the money. He didn't lose it. He didn't lose anything. And for that, it is stripped of him. He is reprimanded. He is yelled at. And he is completely ostracized from the community. Kicked out. And we're supposed to believe, if this wealthy landowner is God, that this is how God treats those who are scared, who are fearful. And there are those who have looked at this parable and thought, I think what this parable is really about is that Jesus is looking at the way that the earthly society operates. How those who are rich are made richer, and those who are poor are made poorer or are completely left out. And he tells this parable as a criticism of that societal ideal. And it might seem kind of like a radical way of looking at this parable, but it's certainly not a radical departure from the rest of Jesus' teaching and the rest of the gospel teachings. I mean, think about when Mary first hears that she's going to give birth to Jesus, and she visits Elizabeth, and remember the baby jumps in her womb, and she sings this wonderful song about how the lowly are going to be lifted up, and the rich are going, and the powerful are going to be made low. And you think back to last week, when we talked about the workers in the vineyard, and how the first workers and the last workers were treated equally. Even though the first ones had worked so very hard and the last ones, they had only worked a little bit. Because in that great reversal, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And so by talking about these talents in this way, Jesus is criticizing those who treat the last so poorly. Saying, this is how your world operates and it is not acceptable. And so I think that maybe the lesson for us today is that we need to really evaluate how we value wealth and how we treat the least of these. But I got a problem with this interpretation as well, because it neglects a few things. And one of those is where this parable shows up in the text. If we do a little bit of textual context analysis, remember when we were talking about context and textual context, if we look at that, where this appears, this parable actually appears in the middle of two other parables. The first one is about the 10 young maidens and their oil lamps, right? They are waiting for the master to return, and so they have to keep the oil in their lamps burning so that they are always ready for the master's return. And the parable after the talents is the one, as I referenced earlier, the parable about separating the sheep from the goats, which is really a parable about judgment of one's actions. And I think that this parable of the talents comes right in the middle of those two as kind of a bridge, because it has elements of both parables, right? It's a parable about waiting for a master to return and being ready for that. But it is also a parable about judgment, because when this master comes back, there is certainly an accounting given to the servants. And so we look at this parable and we see it through our eyes. And I think one of the issues that when we, even if we don't look at it from a position of skills, we still might have biases based on kind of a American Protestant work ethic, right? We look at it and we say, oh, well, the first two servants worked hard and they deserve that money. And that last servant, he didn't do anything. Just like Elaine's substitute teacher, just canceled all the classes. Didn't do a thing, and so doesn't deserve a thing. But this is where we have to remember that we are putting our own viewpoints onto this parable. And in fact, in Jesus' time, this parable would have been seen much differently. In fact, the first two servants would have been seen as greedy, as unholy, unrighteous, worldly even. And the last servant would have been seen as humble and righteous. Richard Rohrbach, who wrote about this parable in the Bible Archaeological Digest, gives this observation. He says that given the limited good outlook of ancient Mediterranean cultures, seeking more was considered morally wrong because the pie was limited and was already distributed, which meant that in order for you to get more, somebody else had to have less. So why would Jesus tell a parable about taking from the poor, about the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and holding this up as an example for the kingdom of heaven? Well, because we have to remember that what we're talking about here is not economics, but Godonomics. And money doesn't mean money in these parables. Money equates to value. And what is valuable to God is not the same thing that is valuable to the world. And so when the people heard this parable, and it was shocking to them, and said, I can't believe that these servants would take from this poor, lowly servant, or take from others and gain so much more money. That is so much money. Who are they taking this money from? When Jesus is talking about the kingdom, he's not talking about money. I believe that what Jesus is talking about when he talks about talents is not even skills. I believe that if he is talking about are these intangible and amazing gifts from God. Gifts that Jesus came to proclaim to the people. Gifts that God is a merciful God. That God's grace extends to everyone. That God's love is abundant. That God's love is a gift that he brings to the people. That this message was through this life of Jesus. He is a living example of what it means to love and care for others. And so in this kingdom, the gifts that are given, this love, this grace, this welcoming, this mercy, these gifts can only grow if they are invested, if they are shared. And unlike the world, unlike the economics part of it, when these gifts are increased, they don't come from, people do not have less. In fact, when these gifts are given and shared, it is actually increases. So overall, the pie gets bigger. When the love is shared, the love grows. When the grace is shared, the grace grows. When mercy is shared, mercy grows. When welcoming is shared, it grows. And so looking at it from this context, on how things have to be shared in order for them to flourish, we can look at this third servant in kind of a different light. That is actually in the kingdom, it is this third servant that was selfish, that was keeping these ideas to himself, that didn't want to tell others about this kingdom, that didn't want to share these gifts of God, these gifts of mercy with anyone else, that wanted to keep them all to himself because he was afraid of what might happen if he shared them. And what Jesus is saying is, in that kingdom, they don't really have use for people who want to keep it to themselves. He only has use for those who are looking to grow by sharing. So I say all that to say this. Or rather, to ask you this. What are you holding on to? What is it that you are refusing to share? You remember that in the parable, the master leaves, right? And it's up to the workers to do the work. Which is to say that it's up to us to spread this gospel, to spread these ideas. So what are you holding on to? Are you afraid to love without judgment for fear of how you might be perceived? What might people think of you? Are you holding on to resentment because you are afraid to forgive? Are you afraid to let go of your pride? These gifts of God, these gifts of mercy and grace, are not for us to hold on to. Just like they weren't for the disciples to hold on to, as tempting as it might have been to have a little exclusive club. They're to be shared. We in this church can often feel like, well, we come to church, we have our little group, we have our little meetings here, and then we go off and we live our lives. But Jesus' point was, you need to go and invest. You need to take this money out there. You need to take these gifts out there, demonstrate them, show them, live them. The gospel is not for us to keep to ourselves. It will only grow if we share it. It will only grow if we live it out in our everyday lives. And it will increase in invaluable wealth. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.